Now, in chapters 36 and chapters 37, we went through those and more last time here. But we saw how Elihu had been seeking to bring Job into this kind of greater awareness of the greatness of God and the power of God. And so it would appear that Elihu was observing an approaching storm. We see that at the end of chapter 37, where he's kind of describing the storm. It would seem that he's seen the storm coming and coming from a distance there, and he's describing the events going on, the wind, the lightning, the thunder, and he's equating these things to the power and the majesty of God here. Well, now in chapter 38, that storm seems to break now, and we see it's God all along in the midst of that storm. Not just described by the storm, but it's God who's in the storm. Notice what we read in verse 1 of chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, let me pause right there. Now this is interesting because it was a mighty wind that had gone and killed Job's 10 children in the first chapter. Remember that, verses 18 and 19. Mighty wind came, the house came down, collapsed, and his children were all killed in that. But now it's a mighty wind that will come and bring revelation to Job. Understand that God oftentimes comes and he reveals himself in the midst of the storm, but ultimately to show his greatness and his power to us. It happened there at Mount Sinai with Moses and the children of Israel. Remember, the children of Israel were afraid to even go up the mountain. They're like, Moses, you go ahead and let God talk to you. We're afraid. We're going to be wiped out, decimated if we approach him and approach the mountain there. It also happened in the storm that he took up Elijah in the whirlwind to heaven. There, as he spoke to Ezekiel in chapters 1 and 2, God appeared to him in that whirlwind, in that storm. Oftentimes, the storms are the things that bring us to a deeper revelation of God. And we need to be those that are able to embrace those things and to face those challenges, those storms that come, and understand, God, what do you want me to learn through this? And sometimes it's just, what do you want me to learn from you and about you in this? Now, for the last 36 chapters, we've been hearing from Job and his friends. They've been trying to make sense of what has been happening to Job. He's been undergoing some immense and intense trouble and suffering and difficulty. And his friends have been trying to bring the solution so that Job will just get fixed already, right? Here's the reason why, Job. Just repent of your sin and God will heal you. Now, Job primarily has been asking God to come and just simply answer him. Job hasn't been directly asking so much for just a healing, but God, what are you doing in the midst of this? And he wanted God to come and reveal himself and to vindicate Job, right? He wanted to be vindicated, to know, like, listen, I've lived a blameless life. It's not because of sin that I'm suffering, as my friends are saying. God, I want you to come and vindicate me here. This is what Job has been asking. The problem with this is that as Job questioned God and his justice, Job grew a little bit bigger in his own estimation, while God began to shrink in size. That's what happened with Job, is he began to think, I don't deserve this. God, you're just, but why is this happening? I shouldn't have this happen to me. And Job started to kind of grow in his own estimation and size. And it caused God to shrink in his majesty and power and in his sovereignty ultimately. But now that God begins to confront Job, we're going to see that it's God that begins to show his size. And it's God that will begin to grow in size in Job's eyes, and Job will be the one that begins to decrease now, as we see in these next two chapters, as God begins to reveal his power and might. And that's important because proper proportion must always prioritize our perspective. Proper proportion must prioritize our perspective. We need to understand that God is God and we are not. That God is great and I'm not. And so God, you get to have your way. You get to do what you need to do in all these situations. And don't let me think that I deserve better or this isn't fair, because then my proportion, my estimation of myself and of God has shifted and changed. And you see, as we get into this, God isn't going to come and give answers to Job. In fact, he's going to turn the questions around on Job. About 70 questions, to be exact, are going to be posed now to Job by God in this next few or couple of chapters. And understand, there won't be a satisfying answer given to Job as to why he went through the suffering. The only answer that God reveals is that he is the answer. The only answer that God reveals is that he is the answer. In our difficulty and pain, we don't always need to know the whys. We simply need to look to the who and understand that God, you're in control of all this. I may not understand why this is happening, but God, I need to look to you, the one that gives me a peace that surpasses all understanding in the midst of the storm and difficulty and pain and suffering of life. And that's what God desires to do. To simply come and reveal himself in a greater way. To cause us to have a peace that will go beyond any understanding and answers that we might get in the midst of that. It's funny with my kids. I can sit there and debate with them. And they can always, whenever I say something, listen, you can't do this. Why? And I'll give my answer. And guess what? Oftentimes my answer doesn't satisfy them. Why can't I do that? Well, here's why. And they go on. It's like, that's my answer. Sorry, I know you don't agree with it and like it, but that's the answer. They won't argue with me. And sometimes the answers we get aren't always going to solve our difficulty or our understanding. We need a peace that goes beyond understanding, you see. And we just need to get a better understanding that God is God. He is sovereign. I need to trust in his sovereignty in the midst of all these things. And it's through our trials that our revelation of God is often deepened. And so as God begins to answer, or rather question Job, I should say, we'll see God centering on these two main ideas. Chapter 38, 1 to 38, we see, can you describe my creation? This is God questioning Job. Can you describe my creation? And then chapter 38, verse 39 to the end of chapter 39, can you direct my creation? Can you direct my creation? And as these questions are posed, Job will be humbled and he'll be silenced. He will learn quickly that the only real response to life's difficulties and tragedies is to simply trust the Lord, for he's much bigger and greater than us, and he knows what he is doing. Amen to that, right? He knows what he's doing. We need to trust him. So verse 2 says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, prepare yourself like a man. I'll question you. And you shall answer me. So God questions Job in his response to the things that God has done. You see, there were times where Job questioned God and ultimately was questioning his justice. God, this doesn't seem fair or right that you're allowing this to happen to me, a just person, a blameless man. This doesn't seem fair, right? God, where's your justice in all this? He was questioning God. And in allowing Job to go through this, Job was wondering, how can this be right? And so in that, there were moments where Job began to swell with pride and he began to look at his own innocence and be kind of boastful, not prideful in a sense, and think, I don't deserve this, you see. And he was perplexed over the suffering that he endured. On one hand, Job waxed eloquently on what he knew of God, but what he failed to do is realize how much he didn't know about God. This is where Job fell short. He could share a lot of things about what he knew about God, but what he failed to take into account was what he didn't know about God. We shouldn't think that God expected them, and I'm including his friends in this too, when God says, who darkens counsel by words without knowledge. We shouldn't think that God expected all these people to know what they could not know. Rather, God expected them to appreciate that there were aspects to the matter known to God but hidden to man. And these aspects made sense of what seemed to make no sense. But they weren't privy to the whole picture. That's something we've been seeing as we've been going through this. They didn't know the whole account. They didn't have chapter 1 and 2 laid out before them to know what was going on, the scene between Satan and God and why God allowed these things to happen to Job. And that's what we really need to take into account in all things, that there are things that God does that we don't have the complete picture to. We may know much about God, but there's still much more that we don't know about God. And the reason why he does what he does, the reason why things are happening, we don't always have the complete picture. And our only response is to look not to the why, but to the who. To look to God and say, God, I don't understand, I don't get it, but I know that you're at work because you always are. And I need to trust you in that. And so when we try to explain everything that God does as though we have to come up with some sort of answer, we only, as was said of Job, and applicable to all his friends, we only do this. We darken counsel by words without knowledge. What God is implying here is that Job was kind of putting a cloud over the plans and the purposes of God. Darkens, you know, counsel, the purposes, the plans of God that he was intending to do. God was accomplishing something for his glory, and Job and his friends were really speaking without any real understanding or knowledge of that situation, of what God was wanting to do. And so they were questioning the wisdom of God and speaking from a place of ignorance. Let us remember, whatever we do know, there's a whole lot that we don't know, especially when it comes to the ways and to the workings of God. So God tells Job to, what does he say, prepare yourself. All right, Job, prepare yourself. Basically, the Hebrew idiom or the idea here is gird up your loins. And that idiom basically describes taking the hem of the long garment or robe that a man would oftentimes wear, right? And they would gird up their loins. They would pull up that robe, right? It'd be around. And if they need to get busy, need to get active in running or working hard, that robe's just going to get in the way, right? You're going to get tripped up. Ken knows all about that, right? When we're in Israel, you know what that's like. You had to gird up the, and so you got to pull up that robe and you got to, you know, tuck it in your belt. That's what the men would do when they were called to gird up your loins. And we see that throughout the Bible. So God is telling Job, gird up, get ready now. Get ready to be on the move because we're going to go on a little bit of a tour here. All right. Now, Job had longed to have an audience with God, and it's going to go very different than what Job would have imagined as he kind of gets smacked around a little bit through a recap of the greatness and the grandeur of God that God is going to take Job on now. A little tour of the greatness of God. He's going to take Job on this tour of his creation and handiwork that's on display throughout the universe. And we're going to see detailed, you know, cosmology, oceanography, meteorology, astronomy, zoology. These are all things that God has his hands in and on and is overseeing. And so God is going to reveal and show and remind Job of all these things that are going on that maybe Job hasn't been taking into account as to the greatness of God. Look at verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding who determined its measurements. Surely you know, or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened, or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. So God likens now the formation of the earth to a person that goes out and he builds a house. The construction of a building. We see a lot of the same kind of terminology, description, and picture being given here in these verses. And this is how, you know, God's saying, where were you, Job, when all this was going down with me forming, building, shaping the earth and all of the things connected with it? Notice what God says. He lays the foundation, just like how you start the building of a home. You lay the foundation, and then God's stretching out that cosmic tape measure now, and he's determining accurately all the dimensions that need to go into this great construction. And so God kind of says, Job, you're so wise. You must know these things. God kind of speaks with some stinging sarcasm here. You must know all about this because weren't you around? Don't you have great wisdom, Job? Don't you know all these things? How does the earth get anchored in place? How does its foundations hold everything together? Are these questions being posed? Job, were you there when this all happened? Do you have understanding of these things? Basically, it's as if God is telling Job, if you can answer these things, then you're fit to come and question me. If you have wisdom and answers to these things, then you know, yeah. Fair game to come and question me. God says the morning stars and the sons of God, they were there singing together, shouting for joy. And these are references to angels. This tells us that the angels were present during God's creation. They weren't active contributors in any way, but they were there praising God all the while that he is doing his creating. Again, God loves and inhabits his praises. Great things happen in that environment of worship. There in creation, worship is taking place. Now, it amazes me today to hear the theories that man devises to explain the creation of the world. We started off saying, you know, that the earth rested on the back, the shell of a large turtle, right? This is what theory came up where people began to think, how is the earth just suspended there? Well, it's being held up by, you know, the shell of a great turtle. Then it was being held up on Atlas's shoulders. We look back on those theories and we ridicule them, right? We go, oh man, how unwise we were. And it won't be long before we're looking back on the theories of today with ridicule, right? Listen, the thing is, nobody was there except God. The only one that can accurately give us any kind of account or understanding of these things that's given to us through his word. Otherwise, nobody was there to try to come up with some sort of theories, you know, as to how this all happened apart from God is nonsense. It's ridiculous. None of these things can be proven where people say, well, we believe life formed by just this, you know, substance and then evolution kind of took over and everything just sort of evolved. Really? And we pass this off as kind of scientific basis, and yet science has to be proven. It has to be shown. It has to be, seen and experienced in a sense. Those things never were. Nobody's seen any kind of evolutionary process take place. If one person could find a transitional fossil, that enough would be, oh, we're onto something. Hasn't been discovered. And yet we still hold on to this evolutionary theory. And I think people are, like we said on Sunday, I think people are starting to realize and wake up and go, yeah, this just really doesn't make any sense. It takes more faith to believe in that than what the Bible says. But you see, we can look to the one who was there. And we can take great comfort in the fact that we know who is behind all these things, and he has proven himself. We're not just believing in some kind of man-made written story in history. The Bible has proven itself. God has proven himself. And so we can look at all these things and go, yeah, no doubt there was a creator. I mean, that's just kind of common sense, isn't it? But we can say that with all the more fact and belief because of what the Bible says. God was there. God is the one that's hanging all these things in place, determining its measurements, stretching the line upon it. God is the one that did all this. Hallelujah. Verse 8, or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come, but no farther, and here your proud ways must stop. So we move from building to now birthing, in a sense, as we see the waters emerge, come bursting forth with great force as though through or from a womb, is what it says there in verse 8. The seas were seen as a great force, and it brought great fear to the Hebrew mind. And yet God says that he fixed his limit for it. You see, God is in control of all the raging seas. We saw last Sunday in Psalm 104, verse 7. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place which you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. God is the one holding all these things at bay. Putting up a boundary saying, okay, water, you can't. The Hebrew, the Israelite, the Jew was like, man, I don't even want to go near the sea. That thing freaks me out. And yet there's God saying, man, I'm just holding it all at bay. Got a boundary set up there. In the ancient Semitic world, control of the boisterous sea was a unique symbol of divine power and authority. And notice what we read in Luke chapter 8, verse 24 to 25. And they came to him and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we're perishing. Then he arose and he rebuked the wind and the raging of the water. And they ceased, and there was a calm. But Jesus said to them, where's your faith? And they were afraid and marveled, saying to one another, who can this be? For he commands even the winds and water, and they obey him. Isn't that great? I mean, they loved being on the lake because it wasn't the sea. Even though it's called the Sea of Galilee, it's just a lake. It's not a big lake either. But that thing can get pretty raging, as we see here. And they're amazed. Who is this? Because who can control the waters, the storm? Only God can do that. And it's as though God is saying, Job, just go ahead and stand in waist-deep water and try stopping a wave from rolling in. Can you do that, Job? Can you hold back just one wave from crashing? Have you ever tried to do that? Have you ever tried to stand up to a wave and just be like, that thing just knocks you down? I've been knocked over by some pretty big waves myself. Sand in the shorts and all, it's not a fun experience. But yet God commands each wave where to stop. And it's as though God is saying, Job, are you getting the picture of my power yet? I'm holding everything back. Nothing is moving without my saying so. Here your proud waves must stop at the end of verse 11. I love that. Verse 12 goes on to say, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It takes on form like clay under a seal and stands out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld and the upraised arm is broken. Hey, Job, have you told the sun when to rise or given direction when it should set in the evening? That'd be pretty handy, wouldn't it? You know, just to kind of say, you know what? I kind of want to sleep in this morning. Instead of setting your alarm, you just tell the sun, don't rise until 9 o'clock this morning. I just want a little bit more nighttime here, okay? Be pretty handy, right? And yet God's saying, have you commanded the morning since your days began? Have you ever had any kind of control over the sun when it rises, when it sets? If you could control all these things and you could cause the sun to shine throughout the night, he goes on to say, and basically withhold the darkness from the wicked so that they can't carry out their evil works. That's what's meant there in verse 15. From the wicked, their light is withheld. And by their light being withheld, it's really speaking about their darkness is what is being implied here. Their wicked works. They love to operate in the night, in the darkness, when things aren't being exposed. And if you can let and control the sun, you can let the sun shine all the way through. And he says their upraised arm is broken. That arm of rebellion where it's kind of like shaking against God would be broken. They wouldn't be able to do what they want to do. Verse 16, have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Where's the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the path to its home? Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? Job is just shrinking in stature with each question that's being fired his way. Has Job experienced the depths of the sea? There's no way he could. You know what that's like if you've ever gone diving, even just into a deep pool, and you try to go to the bottom, what happens? Your ears, just the pressure mounts, and your ears start to feel that intense pain, right? Anybody experienced that before? Come on, okay. Job didn't have the equipment he needed to get down and explore the depths of the sea. He didn't have the ability to do that. By the way, the known deepest part of the ocean is called the Challenger Deep, located in the Pacific Ocean along the Mariana Trench. It measures approximately 36,200 feet, just under 7 miles deep. That's deep. I mean, Job, gotten anywhere near there? Not a chance. Have you known or searched just the depths of the sea? Have you walked and seen them all? Or have you experienced even just the springs of the sea? This is interesting because, you know, it hasn't been too long ago that they discovered that there are springs sitting in the bottom of the ocean floor. These sources of water contained right there in the sea is pretty amazing. But God has shown them to be there all along, even though we have taken a long time to kind of realize and discover it. Again, science just catching up to what the Bible has already said. It's not the Bible you know, just kind of going, well, all right, that's, now we can see the Bible said. No, it's science catching up with the Bible, not the other way around. They should just go to it to begin with as their source of science literature. Now, remember back in Job chapter 10, verse 18 and 22, Job had desired a retreat from his pain, his suffering. He just wanted to go down to the grave. He's just like, you know, I wish I was never born. I mean, to have to face this, I would rather that I wouldn't have been born. Oh, how nice it'd be just to lie down in the grave and just kind of go to sleep there. That's kind of what Job had been longing for. But God says, have you seen the gates of death? Is this something you can enter on your own? Do you know what you're talking about? Because God alone holds the keys to death and Hades, as Revelation 1:18 says. And God continued questioning Job regarding the expanse of the earth. Verse 18, if you comprehend the breadth of the earth, tell me if you know all of this. Does he have any idea where the light comes from and to where the darkness goes? Could Job lead each of these to its right place? Surely he must know where that is based on how long he's been around. God's kind of saying, surely you know these things based on your age and when you were born. You've been around a long time, Job. You've gained lots of wisdom. Surely you know where the light comes from, the source of it, where the darkness goes, and where you can lead these things to its rightful place. But Job would only be able to sit here and go, no idea. I have no comprehension in those things. You see, though Job has accumulated some great knowledge throughout his existence, there is still so much that he has no idea about. And God is just kind of confronting his intellect here and making Job realize just how small he really is in comparison to all that God is and all that God has done. Verse 22, have you entered the treasury of snow? Or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who has divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land where there is no one, a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? Verse 29. From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. So God speaks of the treasury of snow and hail as though they're being stored up as weapons. That's kind of what's being referred to as this treasury. It's kind of like this treasury of weaponry, in a sense. Now, it's interesting because back in Joshua chapter 10, verse 11, God used a hailstorm to take down the army coming against Gibeon. And it says that more people died from the hailstones than the people of Israel killed with the sword. God didn't need that army of Israel to take care of business. God's just like, hey, you know what? I'll have you guys take part, participate with me, but I'm just going to send some hailstones down, and man, I'll do more damage than you guys ever could. It's interesting, in the great battle of Gog and Magog, as Ezekiel talks about in Ezekiel 38, God will come to Israel's defense by raining down great flooding rain and large hailstones. Ezekiel 38, verse 22 says that. In Revelation 16, 21 says that great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone weighing about the weight of a talent. A talent was 100 to 120 pounds. Some estimated even being higher than that, close to 150 pounds, perhaps. But say the conservative measure of 100 pounds. Could you imagine 100-pound hailstones falling from the sky on you? Can you imagine an army going to battle? F-16s flying, all of a sudden hailstones just start hitting those planes, man. It's gonna have an effect, isn't it? And God is saying, Job, have you seen the treasury of hail that I'm holding? This great mass, weaponry here. Weapons of mass destruction. It's been found. It's right there. In the treasury of hail that God is holding. So God is in control of all these things. He's in control of all the patterns of weather. And he can make it rain where nobody's even living or dwelling, it says there. To cause it to rain in verse 26, on a land where there is no one. Why would you do that? Well, just for his own pleasure. Just let rain come down on this land. I'm going to see crops grow or flowers grow. I'm just going to do it for my own pleasure. Whether it's giving men their sustenance or not. If nobody's there, I'm going to bring rain because why? I'm sovereign and I'm God and I make the rules. So God's in control of these things. Can we have any control of the weather? Not at all. Our experts, our meteorologists can barely predict what it's going to do tomorrow. Right? But God controls what's going to happen tomorrow, and he's not obligated to act according to the forecast. He can do what he wants. God even makes the liquid water harden like stone. Now that was something not always experienced by those lands in of the Bible, right? People in this area would be like, water coming down? Hardening? Frozen? What is this? How does this work? That's just God in his mastery of all things. Verse 31, can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades, or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season, or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? So next, God takes Job through a tour of the constellations. Pretty cool, huh? Job, do you have any idea how these stars all stay formed together? How you can look up in the night sky from one year to the next and still continue to see these constellations in their shape and in their form? They never change. Do you know who's holding those things together? Can you bind those clusters? Can you keep those things together yourself, Job? Do you know how they even function that way? It's amazing. I'm lucky if I can look up and, you know, spot the Big Dipper, let alone keep it functioning the way it does. And yet God is holding all these things together. Guiding the great bear, its cubs, that great constellation across the sky. Where it just keeps repeating itself, showing itself. The message is about God's cosmic dominion of these stars as they seasonally move across the sky. Job understood neither the laws of the heavenly bodies nor God's inscription in the earth. And that is exactly what the Lord was talking to Job about. Job, you just have no idea here. He says in verse 34, can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the mind, or who has given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom, or who can pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together? Job, do you have any ability to go and speak to the clouds to come and send rain? I mean, pagan nations would rely upon their deities, thinking that, you know, it's Baal that's going to control the weather. And it'll be Baal that will bring rain down. There was no Baal. It was a made-up God. He couldn't do anything. God controls this. But he's asking Job, Job, can you do anything about this? Can you talk to the clouds? What about doing your best rain dance? Is that going to do anything, Job? Give that a try. Is that going to bring rain down from the clouds? When dry ground appears, are you able to get the bottles of heaven, he says, to just tip over and send a little trickle down? Can you do any of that? God asks these questions to show that not only is there a lot that Job doesn't know, but there's a lot that Job can't do. He and we are simply reliant on the Lord to be our help and our answer in every situation. God is our help. He's our answer in all things. And next, God moves on now to ask about Job's ability to manage his creation. As we've seen God describe his creation, we're going to see now God asking, can you direct my creation? It says in verse 39, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs to lie in wait? Who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wander about for lack of food? Job, are you able to secure food for the different animals? And are you able to take care of their needs? Are you able to come and help them? Now I think about these guys. Lions, you know, hunt the prey for the lion. Are you kidding me? I'm not getting anywhere near a lion. I'm not going to do anything about those things, you know? And he's asking, Job, can you help out in any way like that? Not a chance. Verse 1 of chapter 39. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain, they depart and do not return to them. See, there's a lot more that goes into managing creation than just feeding them. Making sure the animals are all, you know, operating on the right cycle, that they're all fulfilling that proper gestation period, right? So that they're able to reproduce. And we see the earth being replenished with these animals. Each animal has its own gestation period that is divinely established by the Lord. God's put that all into place. Some are very different. Some animals can you know, procreate just quickly, right? Elephants, they take almost 2 years carrying their young before they give birth. I mean, so pregnant moms, just, you know, think about that when that eighth month is approaching. It's just like, oh, I'm so glad I'm not an elephant. You might feel like one, but you can be glad you're not having to deal with what the elephant has to go through carrying for almost 2 years, right? So these animals are able to bear their young on their own. They feed them. They have them move on, repeat this cycle themselves now. For instance, the offspring of an ibex doe, right? The ibex doe, unlike human infants that need years of care, can stand up within minutes of being birthed, and they soon can just jump off into the wilderness and start to thrive on their own, right? I mean, we know our offspring take years and years and years before, like, okay, just give it a try on your own now. Try to feed yourself now. You're 22. Go ahead. You can do it. You know? So how does this happen? It's just God has set all things to function as they should here, right? God is taking care of all these things. Who set the wild donkey free in verse 5? Who loosed the bonds of the onager? Whose home I have made the wilderness and the barren land his dwelling? He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. The wild donkey was seen as an enviable creature because he was free to roam. And the onager is just another term for a wild donkey. But who went and set it free, and who has provided for it? Who's directed it where to go, where it can just go and feed off of areas that maybe other animals may not be able to live and survive? Who's established all those things? It's God. God has set it in place and allowed it to go and provide for himself. It's directed of God. Verse 9, will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Now the wild ox, as it says here, it's a bit of a poor translation, okay? And the King James translation says unicorn. So that's an even poorer translation here. Not a good one either. But this animal mentioned here is believed to be the now extinct aurochs. It was extinct since 1627. And this was an enormous animal that was the largest and most powerful land animal next to the rhino and the elephant. Old Testament occurrences of this word use it as a symbol of power and strength. So here was this animal, you know, fierce, enormous. And there's a bit of divine humor at play here, again, suggesting that this fearsome creature could possibly be harnessed by Job and used in just domesticated work. Or go and bed down beside the manger. You need a teddy bear? Here, take one of the aurochs here, Job, and just go and have a good night's rest with this thing. The thing would maul you to death, you know, in your sleep. Roll over on you, you'd be crushed. And so God is kind of jesting with Job a little bit here. Do you think this animal's going to work for you? Do you think you can control this thing? Not at all. God continues on with a bit of humor here, looking at verse 13. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? For she leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly, as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern, because God deprived her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the horse and its rider. So why would a large bird like an ostrich have wings and not be able to fly? Why, God, would you make something like that? Job, can you answer that question? Why does the ostrich exist? Again, it doesn't make sense to us, but in God's sovereignty, he doesn't need to make sense to us, because all he does is good and sensible, whether we understand it or not. Now, some suggest that the ostrich is for God's pleasure and amusement only, right? He's deprived it of wisdom. Maybe God just has these ostriches running around, you know, sticking their head in the sand, laying their eggs, or mistreating, and just like God's going, oh, these birds, man, these things just crack me up. They're just so fun to watch, aren't they? I don't know. It'd be a good nickname for many of us, ostrich, deprived of wisdom. That could be us, right? Yet in all her stupidity, you know, placing eggs on the ground where they can be crushed, the ostrich is still around. Ostrich still survives. Who's responsible for that? God. God's at work. It's evident through seeing ostriches still around. And the ostrich can go and show itself strong and being able to go and outrun a horse and its rider. God keeps sustaining this animal. Verse 19, have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet is sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. So next up is the horse, not a farm horse here, but a war horse, a horse that's prepared for battle. Job, did you have anything to do with making this horse so strong and courageous that it'll run head on into the most dangerous of situations with spears clashing up against it, you know, and just coming and mocking at fear, as it says? Job, are you responsible for any of that? Have you trained that horse to do that? Who created it to do this? It's a work of God. Verse 26, does a hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings toward the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells and resides. On the crag of the rock in the stronghold, from there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. So the hawk is mentioned first, and its migrating practices is discussed here. It flies to the south, not because of some man-made training. How does it know to leave its place of inhabitant for this period of time and go to a different place of inhabitant for another period of time? How does it know to do that? It's all built into it by God. Consider, for example, the winter vacation of the golden plover. I love this. This bird lives in Alaska during the summer months. When the winter approaches, it sets off on its epic voyage to Hawaii, which is what I like to do myself. But this involves a non-stop flight, which takes it across the open sea, where no island punctuates the watery expanse. In addition, this bird cannot swim, can't take any reprieve by just dunking down in the water and taking a little rest. This bird flies all the way from Alaska non-stop to Hawaii. How does it know where to go? How does it know when it's going to get there? Or if it's gotten off track, he's got to navigate through shifting wind conditions that might throw it off course, and yet it always gets himself back on course. And he's got to fuel up. When you take a long flight, that flight has to be sure that it's got a full amount of fuel. This bird has to fuel himself up so that he can make that flight. without losing fuel, without losing strength, and continues on. How does it know how to get there? And the first, it's got to make that flight for the first time at some point. You can figure out maybe after 10 or so flights, oh, sure, they got this pretty, you know, narrowed down now. But that first flight, how does it know? God has built in this incredible GPS system right into this bird where they know how to navigate through to different migratory practices. It's amazing. We can't train a bird to do that. That's God has built it into them. It's amazing. The eagle knows, goes on to talk about the eagle, and it knows to build its nest way up high on the rocky cliffs where it becomes a stronghold fort. How does it know to do this? God built it into them. And they've been created with exceptional vision so that while they're up high in the nest, they can look down and see their prey perfectly. Eagle eyes, right? We use that as an expression because it's true. God has built them this way. And the eagle will devour its prey's carcass, return to feed its young, and the young will suck up the bloody raw meat, no problemo. That's what it says there. They just go and they suck up the blood there. That's the way God has made them. Gross to us, but that's just the way God's provided for them. So the 12 animals described here, we see six beasts, five birds, we see an insect, a locust there. They all exhibit the creative genius and providential care of God. Fittingly, the list begins with the lion, the king of the beasts, and ends with the word for eagle, the king of the birds. Job's incompetence and ignorance are seen in that he could not provide food for the first two animals, did not know the birth of their offspring, did not set them free or tame them, did not give them their odd ways or provide them with their ability of flight. One might think that animals, being under man, could be controlled and cared for by man, but God showed Job that he was in some ways inferior even to the animal kingdom. Job, there's a lot that you don't know, and there's a lot that you can't do. But guess what? I can do all things. I'm God because I set all these things into motion. I set all these things into play. One thought and one only is brought into the foreground. The world is full of mysteries. Strange, unapproachable, overpowering mysteries that you cannot read. Trust in the power and in the wisdom and in the goodness of Him, the Almighty One who rules it. That's all we have to go on, is to trust in the Lord, because He is indeed in control of all these things around us. And we don't know how He does it all. We don't need to know. Because the minute that we can figure out all that God is doing, then we have no need for God. There are things that are going to be left in mystery for us, and we have to be comfortable with that, to go, God, I know that I'm not going to know everything, but I take comfort in the fact that I know the One who knows it all and is directing it all, governing it all, and sustaining it all. God's the One, so we take great comfort in that. Job here doesn't get any answers that he's looking for, but what does he get? A greater revelation of God. That's what we need to do when we come to places, situations in our lives where we're feeling pressured, we're feeling like our back's up against the wall, or we're feeling like we're experiencing some insurmountable pressure or pain. We need to get a greater glimpse of God in the midst of that, to know that, God, You're all that I need in those times. I don't always need to look just for the escape. I need to simply escape to You and get a greater revelation of who You are, of Your greatness, of Your strength, of Your love, of Your might, of Your care for me in the midst of it all. That's what Job was getting here. Well, we're going to end with just a song that goes along with this, and it's a neat video, a little visual here, some of these things that we've talked about here tonight. And so let me pray, and then we'll watch this video to close. Lord, we thank You for this time tonight here, and we thank You, God, for the fact that You came and You showed up and You addressed these things to Job. and to his friends, and not in a way that they were hoping or expecting, but what you did, God, was just reveal yourself, your might, your power, your greatness, the grandeur of your creation, the fact that you're sustaining it all, holding it all together. And God, help us to see that more clearly here tonight, and to see you more clearly, to know that when things are mounting against us, we just need to cling to you and get a greater picture of the goodness and the greatness of God. Reveal yourself to us here tonight, Lord. You've already been doing that through your word, but may that continue on now. May those that might be here tonight, or maybe couldn't be here tonight because their hearts are just weighed down. There's pressure mounting in life. Maybe they're going through sickness and suffering and pain. And I pray right now for those people that, Lord, you would just reveal yourself to them in a fresh way, in a strong way, in a way that helps them to see and know that they're not alone, and that you love them, and that you're bigger than their problems. You're greater than their difficulties. And what we need to do is look to you, God, and see the bigness of our God, so that our problems decrease in size, so that we decrease in size, so that it's not about us, but it's about you. That we would trust in your sovereignty in all these